Well, thank you very much, Mark, for the introduction. Thanks also for inviting me to speak to you this evening. Mark suggested that I should speak for about three quarters of an hour or so and then invite questions and answers. And I'm happy to stick to that format, but I should emphasise that people should feel welcome to interrupt before we get to the three-quarter hour mark if they have questions about anything that I've said or if anything that I've said requires clarification. I'm somewhat alarmed to see some philosophers in the audience because I ought to forewarn those of you that are philosophers that this will be very familiar material, I expect. I'm not planning to say anything this evening that I'm sure you haven't heard many times before. But for the non-philosophers, perhaps it will be that little bit fresher, although I dare say that I'll be rehearsing a lot of thoughts that you've had as well. But with luck, in the course of going over some of the basic points that I want to cover this evening, I'll be raising questions that we can explore in further depth in the Q&A session afterwards. Now, excuse me, Mark has introduced me as speaking to you this evening about the problem of suffering, and I suppose the title itself already is a little bit problematical. The very idea that there's such a thing as the problem of suffering. Suffering is something that raises all sorts of problems and difficulties, and one of the issues that arises, I think, is how the various different problems that are associated with suffering relate to one another. And I suppose the first thing that I want to emphasise is that, very broadly speaking, we can distinguish between what you might call an intellectual problem that arises in connection with suffering and all the many practical problems that arise in connection with suffering. And one of the issues, one of the questions that I want to raise this evening is how these two broad categories of problems relate to each other. What's the relationship between the intellectual problem and the practical problem? Although actually I probably should continue to talk in terms of problems even within these broad categories. And the other thing that probably goes without saying, but I'll say it anyway, by talking about problems of suffering in this context, I mean problems that arise for somebody that has some sort of theistic belief, somebody who believes in a God on a fairly traditional conception of a God, has to grapple with problems that don't necessarily arise for an atheist who doesn't share that basic belief. And in particular, that's true of what you might call the most basic intellectual problem that arises. It's a problem that arises for a theist on a traditional conception of theism, because it looks as if the very existence of suffering poses a threat to their theism. That's the basic intellectual problem, or the shape of the intellectual problems, if we want to continue to use the plural. The practical problems that arise are obvious. I mean, all sorts of issues that confront anybody who has a belief in God about how that should affect their attitude to suffering, whether it's their own suffering or the suffering of other people. And we'll come back to those practical problems later. But initially, and in fact for most of this evening, it's the intellectual problem that I want to focus on. And we can put it very succinctly. I mean, there's a very, very simple argument based on the existence of suffering against the existence of God as traditionally conceived. And the traditional conception of God involves the belief that God is both perfectly good, perfectly benevolent, on the one hand, and on the other hand, omnipotent or all-powerful. And the basic argument is this, and it's an argument that I'm sure is familiar to all of you. It's a very simple argument. A being that was perfectly good, perfectly benevolent, would want to eliminate suffering. Suffering is something that would be an offence to such a being, and such a being would want to get rid of suffering insofar as it was able to. But a being that's omnipotent, all-powerful, would be able to get rid of any suffering that there was. That would be part of what it would be to be all-powerful, capable of doing anything whatsoever. And so we're talking about a being that both wants to eliminate suffering and has the capacity to eliminate suffering. And it seems to follow that if there were such a being, there would be no such thing as suffering. And yet we also have, apparently, the stark reality that there is suffering, a lot of suffering. And we're all familiar with it to varying degrees. And so we have this very simple argument that there can't be a God as traditionally conceived, given the existence of suffering. That's the basic argument. Now, there are various ways in which a theist might try to resist this argument. But I think it's fair to say, and perhaps in some ways intuitively clear as well, that the ways of resisting this argument are going to fall into four broad categories. You can see straight away that there are four families of ways in which you're going to resist this argument, if you're going to resist it at all. And what I have in mind is the thought that we could look again at the question whether God has to be perfectly good, perfectly benevolent. So actually go back to that premise and ask whether we need to accept that premise. The second thing that we could do is we could reconsider the whole question of God's omnipotence. Is that something that we're necessarily committed to? Do we have to accept that that's part of the traditional conception of God, or is it is? If it is, do we have to accept the traditional conception of God? The third thing that we could do is reconsider whether the existence of suffering is as straightforward as it seems. I mean, we're just taking for granted that there's such a thing as suffering. Is it possible that actually there's only the illusion of suffering? Or is it possible that although there is such a thing as suffering, it's not the imperfection in creation that it might appear to be? So, we don't have to see this as something that a perfectly good and perfectly powerful being would necessarily want to eliminate. And then the fourth and final way in which the argument might be resisted is simply by challenging the very validity of the argument. So I'm imagining somebody that does accept all the premises, does admit that God has to be benevolent, perhaps by definition, does admit that God has to be all-powerful, again, perhaps by definition, does accept the existence of suffering, but queries the validity of the argument which purports to show that these things are incompatible with one another. So those are the four broad categories into which ways of resisting the argument can be classified. And I'll say a little bit more about each of them. I'll say a little bit more about three of the four. I'm not going to say any more at this stage about the idea that God may not be perfectly good. We can certainly come back to that in the question and answer session if anybody particularly wants to. But at this stage in the discussion, I'll put that to one side. Not because it's not an interesting option, but I think it's probably fair to say that it's proved the least popular way of approaching this problem. And, I mean, there have been examples of people who have taken this approach, but by and large, it's the other three solutions that have proved more attractive. So let's turn to the idea that God is all-powerful and think about the ways in which people have thought twice about that and have reconsidered whether a theist needs to be committed to God's omnipotence. Well, there are various ways in which people have been quite comfortable with, as it were, reigning in God's omnipotence and still thinking that they're operating with a fairly traditional conception of God. And in particular, you'll often find people who are prepared to say, well, look, not even God can violate the laws of logic. There are basic, fundamental, logical principles which even an omnipotent being can't interfere with. And people will say that God is constrained by logic and that we don't have to think of that as much of a concession. You know, there's still a sense in which God's all-powerful. It's just that we have to say that God can do anything that's logically possible, not anything whatsoever. And then people have thought that this in turn is relevant to the particular problem that we're discussing this evening, the problem of suffering, because, for example, the suggestion is often made that it's a matter of logic that there can't be anything good if there isn't also something bad with which to contrast it. So, again, as a matter of logic, there's this price that you have to pay for there being anything good at all. And the claim is often made that God is subject to that fundamental logical principle, and God's own goodness demands that there should be something bad to set against it, so that the goodness makes a certain kind of sense that it couldn't otherwise make. And people put that forward as a principle of logic and say, look, not even God can get round this basic principle of logic. So you find people arguing in that way. Of course, and there's a huge amount to be said about this, obviously, but even if that fundamental move is a good one, I mean, even if there's something to be said for trying to resist the argument in that way, there are bound to be all sorts of questions that remain lurking. And in particular, you might think, well, okay, so perhaps this is a way of accounting for the existence of a certain amount of suffering, but does there need to be as much as there is? The argument in itself looks as if it only requires the bare existence of suffering, and yet we look around us and see quite a lot. So even somebody that was sympathetic to this train of thought might still be suspicious about whether it's really helping us with the basic intellectual problem that we started off with. But at any rate, that's the second of the four categories that I was distinguishing earlier, the four broad ways of trying to resist this argument, calling into question God's absolute omnipotence and seeing whether that might give us a leverage on this problem. The third thing, the third category, the third broad category, is to think again about the very existence of suffering. And there have been people in all sorts of different traditions who have seriously questioned whether there is such a thing as suffering. It seems a very, very basic datum, and I've been more or less taking it for granted so far in my comments this evening. But there are people who are prepared to take the line that actually there isn't suffering, there's only the illusion of suffering. Or, to put it somewhat differently, that there isn't imperfection, there's only the illusion of imperfection. That the very idea that the world can be improved in various ways is an illusion. And plenty of people throughout history have been happy to try and defend that view, and that's been a way again of trying to come to terms with this basic problem for any theist. So there are all sorts of things that people might have in mind if they go for this basic strategy. Let's look at it in particular in terms of the idea of imperfection. And let's imagine somebody who is prepared to admit that there is such a thing as suffering, so they're not actually querying the existence of suffering in the way that others do, but what they are doing is they're calling into question the idea that that's a blemish in reality, or a blemish in creation. So the 17th century philosopher Leibniz is a famous example of somebody who argued in these terms, and he's also famous, equally famous, for having proclaimed that, to put it in Leibniz's own terms, that this is the best of all possible worlds, that actually creation cannot be improved, that the world that we find ourselves in is as good as it gets, is as good as it can possibly be. And Leibniz's view was that the world seems improvable to us. We think we can see all sorts of ways in which creation could be improved, but that's simply and purely because we're looking at details out of context. And there are various analogies that Leibniz had to illustrate this idea. But I think perhaps one of the simplest and most powerful analogies was, he asked you to imagine that you had some beautiful painting on a vast canvas, a magnificent work of art in which all the parts of the painting cohere in some glorious way and contribute to the beauty, to the aesthetic quality of the whole. He asked you to imagine that you had such a painting, but for one reason or another, you could only see a tiny part of it. Perhaps all but a tiny part in the bottom left-hand corner has been covered up in some way. And so you only have access to a little portion of this painting. And what you can see, I mean, it may literally be, you know, a square millimetre in the bottom left-hand corner. What you can see just makes no sense to you. I mean, there's just a massive colour there. If indeed there's a massive colour, I mean, it might be monochrome, it might just be boring. I mean, who knows, it depends exactly what's going on in the bottom left-hand corner. But at any rate, you're completely oblivious to the beauty of the whole thing. And what you're doing is you're concentrating on a small portion of this painting, which you're seeing out of context. And if somebody asked you, can this painting be improved? You might well, on the strength of the little bit that you can see, you might think, yes, there are countless ways of improving this. As it is, it's just meaningless colour. But then if the rest of the painting has been co- covered up, you can imagine that the cover is removed and suddenly you're able to see that tiny portion in the context of the whole, and suddenly what previously seemed meaningless and unintelligible starts to make sense. You can see precisely why there's that portion of colour there, because of how it contributes to the whole canvas. And I mean, it's a bit fanciful, I suppose, to imagine that we're looking at the best of all possible paintings. It's hard to imagine what the best of all possible paintings would be. But you get the idea. You can see how this analogy is supposed to work. The very, very basic thought that when you're just looking at a little bit taken out of context, you're not going to be aware of how it contributes to the whole, and you're going to think that there's scope for improving that small portion and therefore for improving the whole, and you might be completely mistaken about that. That was Leibniz's basic argument. And so he was prepared to accept that this is in fact the best of all possible worlds. And if only we were in God's position, if only we could see the world in the way that God sees it, we would be able to see that there was no scope for improvement. And the suffering that we experience is just, as it were, a local price that we have to pay for the glory of the whole, for the benefit of the whole. So this is a very, very straightforward way of resisting the original problem of suffering as an argument against the existence of a perfectly good, all-powerful God. Leibniz says, yes, there is a perfectly good, all-powerful God, and it is true that if there were such a God, the world would be as good as it could possibly be. But actually, there's no problem here, says Leibniz, because the world is as good as it can possibly be. The fault is ours for thinking that it could be better. So that's the third broad category that I was distinguishing earlier, the third category of solutions to the problem, focusing on the idea that there is suffering, or the idea that there's imperfection in creation. And then fourthly and finally, you get what I suppose historically has been the most popular approach to the problem, which is to challenge the idea that there's an incompatibility in the first place. So in various ways, people have just resisted the very idea that the original argument was a good argument. So I have in mind people who are theists on the traditional conception. They accept God's perfection. They accept God's omnipotence. They admit that the world is imperfect and that things could be better in various ways. What they deny is that there's the tension between these that there appears to be. And there are various ways in which they might try to do that, but the most popular approach, the most popular form that this reaction to the argument has taken, is to bring in considerations about human free will. So the idea is that God, in his benevolence, has created creatures that have free will, that have the capacity to make their own decisions, make their own choices, lead their own lives. And it's good that there are such beings, and it's understandable that a benevolent God should create such beings, because that's something that's intrinsically good. But then some of the onus is off God, because the whole point is that these are creatures that can that can make their own decisions. God, in his benevolence, has created these beings. It's up to these beings how they then exploit this gift of freedom that they've been given. And the traditional view is that they abuse the gift and exercise their freedom in ways that are fundamentally bad. And that's why there's suffering. That's the way the story goes. It's not God's fault, it's our fault, or it's the fault of the creatures that God has created, who have abused their gift of freedom. And that's why, or that's one of the reasons why, what I'm calling this evening the problem of suffering is often referred to not as the problem of suffering, but as the problem of evil, because the word evil, it particularly calls to mind this idea of an abuse of freedom, exercise of freedom in the way in which it should not be exercised. And the thought is that the reason why there's suffering is that there is evil, there's human evil. And to go back to something that I said right at the very beginning, we naturally take for granted that suffering is something that would offend against a benevolent deity. And people who take this approach say, well, yes, it does offend against a benevolent deity. The suffering that there is in the world saddens God as much as it saddens us. The fault doesn't lie with God, the fault lies with us. And then, of course, the question is whether this whole approach can succeed. I mean, can this be a good way of accounting for the suffering that we were concerned with at the outset? I mean, is it really plausible that the fault all lies with God's creatures rather than with God? So you might think, look, there's a huge amount of suffering that certainly is our fault, but on the face of it, there appears to be plenty of suffering that doesn't have anything to do with us. Now, on the face of it may be the operative phrase. I mean, perhaps if you explore in greater depth, you begin to see all sorts of connections that aren't immediately obvious. But certainly, if you're looking at this in a relatively superficial way, just confronting the data as they initially strike us, there do seem to be all sorts of ways in which people suffer and non-human animals suffer as well, for that matter, for which it looks as if we can't incur the blame. Yes, a lot of it's down to us, but no, it doesn't seem to be all down to us. So there's a whole family of questions that arise at this point about how successful this approach to the problem of suffering can be. But historically, it's been the most popular, and it's certainly part of a fairly mainstream theology, and it's part of a fairly mainstream Christianity as well, to think in these terms and to see this fundamental connection between suffering and human free will. So I'm painfully aware that a lot of what I've said is already very familiar to you, and that you may well have already thought about these issues in a lot of depth, and there may in fact have been nothing new in what I've just said. But let me introduce a final twist, which perhaps is slightly novel. And I want to go back to what I said right at the very beginning about the thought that there isn't such a thing as the problem of suffering. There are various different problems, and there are practical problems that arise as well as intellectual problems. Now, most of what I've been talking about this evening has been concerned with the problem on an intellectual level. But I think there are some interesting questions that arise as well about how we see the relationship between those intellectual challenges and the various practical challenges that people face because of suffering. Now, as far as the intellectual challenge is concerned, for what it's worth, my own view is that none of the traditional approaches to this problem succeeds. I think there's an intellectual problem there that remains unsolved. For anybody that believes in God on a traditional conception of God, the existence of suffering, I think, poses an intellectual challenge to which there is no satisfactory answer, or at least none that has been forthcoming so far. It doesn't stop me, as somebody who has a belief in God and as a philosopher, it doesn't stop me from continuing to wrestle with the intellectual problem. But I don't think, for the record, I don't think that any of the traditional approaches to this problem are successful. But then there's a kind of meta-level problem that arises, which is, what are we even doing when we wrestle with the intellectual problem in the way that we do? I mean, of course, it's natural for us to wrestle with the intellectual problem in the way that we do, and it's particularly natural in a university context of this kind. Of course, we're going to be interested in these intellectual challenges, and if you have a belief in God, there's a sense in which it would be an abnegation of responsibility if you weren't prepared to front up to these intellectual challenges. But what are we doing, and how does it relate to the various practical problems that we confront? And I have in mind something that seems to me to be quite a serious difficulty about even grappling with the problem at all. And the thought is this. In a way, what we're trying to do when we confront the intellectual problem is we're trying to justify the existence of suffering. We're trying to explain it. We're trying to put it in a context that makes sense, so that we can reach a kind of intellectual peace. And we can say, okay, now I see that it does make sense. Now I see that there has to be suffering for whatever reasons, X, Y, and Z. And if the suffering that we're exercised by is our own suffering, then there's a certain rationale to that, and it's an enterprise that itself makes a certain kind of sense, not just intellectual sense, but at a practical level. And I think it probably is true that some people have found practical comfort from trying to get a grip on the intellectual problem. But that's when the suffering is their own. And the thing that somewhat disturbs me, and the thing that I'm particularly interested to hear your reactions to this evening when we come to the question and answer session, is how comfortable we can be with that sort of attitude when the suffering that we're concerned with is not our own suffering, but the suffering of other people. So we look around the world and we see all sorts of suffering, and in particular we see a lot of suffering that's perhaps much greater than anything that we ourselves have to contend with. And the idea that we should, as it were, be able to find some sort of solace in an intellectual solution to the intellectual problem in the face of that suffering seems in a curious sort of way to be out of kilter with what it is that we're actually confronting. It seems like a kind of arrogation. It's as if we're not taking the suffering seriously enough. I mean, what you really should be doing with suffering when you confront it, and in particular what you should really be doing with other people's suffering when you confront it, is responding to it in some appropriate way. I mean, a huge amount's going to depend on the particular suffering, the kind of suffering that we're talking about, and the particular form that your confrontation with it takes, and how far you may or may not be in a position to do anything about it. But if, for example, you are in a position to alleviate that suffering, then, to put it very crudely, your first priority should be to do that. You ought to be out there in the world engaging with it, not in your ivory tower, intellectualizing about it. That's the worry. That's the worry, that the very process of addressing the intellectual problem of suffering might, if you're not careful, be a way of not properly engaging with the practical problem of suffering. Now, simply making that point doesn't make either of these problems go away, and it certainly doesn't do anything to make the intellectual problem disappear. I mean, that's still there in the background, and people are still going to want to think about it. Inevitably, people are going to want to think about it. But I suppose there are two things that slightly disturb me. There's the thought that we should be thinking about it at all in the context of the reality of suffering, and then there's the further thought that we should be toying with the idea that this suffering has a kind of justification, an intellectual justification, which again doesn't seem to me to take suitably seriously the practical problems that we confront. There is a first person, third person asymmetry here that I've already commented on. It may be that there's a kind of rationale that's perfectly adequate and perfectly acceptable when what you're talking about is your own suffering, but the problem takes on a different dimension and a different kind of seriousness, I think, when what you're talking about is the suffering of other people. Well, I think I've been going for about 3/4 of an hour, and I'm well aware that, as I've already said, I'm well aware that some of this is already very familiar to a lot of you, and I'm also well aware that I've just raised questions and not supplied any answers. Well, that's philosophers for you. But perhaps this is an opportunity to open it up and for me to hear something about your views. Yes.
I was curious if that like there's no sound kind of intellectual solution to the problem of suffering. So I was curious what would be your critique against planning as free will, de jure sort of events.
Yeah, so you're basically asking, I guess, what it is about the fourth of the four approaches that I find unacceptable. what about the free will defense? I guess I have a number of concerns about it. One of which I've already mentioned, the point that I already made, which is it's just not obvious enough to me that we have this tight link between suffering and human free will in the first place. There do seem to be plenty of examples of suffering for which it looks as if we can't be blamed. Now, I've already admitted that this is not as straightforward as it seems, and I mean, nothing in this area is as straightforward as it seems. But that's one very, very basic challenge that the free will defence confronts, I think. There is also the thought that, I mean, there's a huge amount that's been written on this, and what I'm about to say is really quite superficial compared with all the arguments that have been advanced in the literature on this topic. But there is the thought that even if it's good that we have free will, and even if free will involves the capacity for evil, even if creatures that have free will are by definition able to abuse that free will and to commit evil, it's also possible for them to exercise their free will in ways that are good. It's possible for creatures that have free will only ever to do the right thing. I mean, that's as possible, a correct, good use of their freedom is as possible as a bad abuse of their freedom. So, God creates these creatures that have free will. It's possible for them to exercise their free will in ways that are fundamentally good. A truly omnipotent being ought to be able to realize any possibility. So, is it obvious that God couldn't have created a world in which there were creatures who freely did the right thing all the time? I mean, the way I set it up earlier, I said that once God had created us and endowed us with freedom, that it was then down to us what happened. But if we're thinking of God in reasonably traditional terms, then we, I mean, there's a word that I haven't used at all this evening so far, the omniscience. I mean, there's the fact that God is all-knowing as well, which I guess is a further complication that comes into the picture. But an all-knowing being will see in advance what the consequences of any creation will be. And we'll hold back from creating creatures who are going to abuse their freedom if he can see in advance that that's what they're going to do. So, you know, you'd expect a perfectly good, all-knowing, all-powerful God, even if it was good to create beings with free will, to hold back from doing that unless he could see that they were going to exercise their free will to the best all the time. So, I mean, I'm sure you're familiar with the moves and counter moves. I mean, there are responses to that as well. But there are these very, very basic concerns that I personally have with the free will defense.
Thank you, Professor. Thank you, Professor, for what I thought was a really insightful.
insightful and helpful talk. I have two questions. First, the continental philosopher Paul Ricoeur responds to the problem of evil by saying, by taking what I think is a different strategy from what you've outlined. He says that from the perspective of Christian faith, you just have to jettison the law of non-contradiction in the first place, which underpins the entire artifice of the intellectual problem. I'd be interested in your comments on that, i.e. the idea that Christian faith requires you to bend the laws of logic a bit. Second question relates to how much of the Christian theological tradition, particularly St. Augustine, has a particular understanding of evil as metaphysically parasitic on the good. So evil isn't anything by itself, but is a corruption or a privation of good, of the good. My gut feeling is that a lot of the responses to the problem of evil, or the problem of suffering, are to some degree at odds with that classical Christian understanding of evil, but I'm not quite sure. I'd also appreciate a comment on that.
Two very interesting questions. I mean, I think as far as the second question is concerned, you're quite right. We have to take seriously the idea that suffering or evil shouldn't be seen as something positive in its own right, but some kind of absence or negation of what's good, privation of good, and that's there is an important tradition of thought along those lines. I suppose, I mean, the first and most obvious thing to be said in response to that is that whatever benefits there may be from thinking of suffering and evil in that way, and you know, perhaps they're quite significant, and perhaps it is an important way of thinking of them, it just isn't obvious that it helps with this particular problem, with the problem of suffering or the problem of evil, because you know, you seem to just be back at square one, even if you're thinking of suffering and evil in these negative terms. Well, okay, but why should there be this absence of good? I mean, if you've got this belief in a perfectly good, all-powerful being, which can be understood in purely positive terms, and whose goodness and power can be understood in purely positive terms, why isn't that the end of the story? I mean, how can there be these various areas of privation or absence, dense in God's perfect goodness, if you like? So, you know, there's a sense in which that just takes us back to square one, or at least, you know, we still need to hear a story about why it doesn't.
Well, it almost makes the problem of evil even worse if there are aspects of the Christian theological tradition that are especially jarring with some of the solutions that we come up with.
Can you say a little bit more about that? About why you think it might make the problem even worse?
Well, so for instance, if I articulate a conception of free will defense, which in my mind seems to make evil something necessary, that seems to me to be giving evil some positive conception. So if I want to hold on to the Augustinian idea of evil as something with no positive existence in itself, then I have even more reason to reject the popular solution to the problem of evil.
Right, okay. So there are, I mean, at the very least, there are still serious complications. The other question that you raised takes us right back to the question of God's omnipotence. A question is a question about the relationship between God and logic, basically. to what extent we think that God is constrained by logic, and to what extent we think God's creation is constrained by logic, and is it possible that we can get round this whole problem by just accepting a fundamental contradiction as part of reality? So, you know, as it were, yes, there's tension between, logical tension between God's existence and the existence of suffering, but that doesn't mean that we should reject either God's existence or the existence of suffering. Rather, what it means is that there's tension in reality. That would be the view. So that's just a massive, massive philosophical issue that you're raising, and I don't know what I could usefully say this evening in response to that. I mean, we could discuss that at enormous length, but it is, I mean, it is an important point that you're raising, and it does force anybody who thinks that God is omnipotent in some interesting sense, but who also thinks that God is constrained by logic, it forces anybody in that position to ask themselves, why is logic privileged in this way? You know, we think God is constrained by logic, but not constrained by physics. God could alter the laws of physics if he wanted to, but for some reason God can't alter the laws of logic, even if he wanted to. Now, you know, plenty of people do adopt that position, and it's not a crazy position, it's a very, very reasonable position, but it does force them to consider why logic is privileged in this way. And not for one minute wanting to suggest that there are no interesting answers to that question, but it's an important question, and you're right to raise it. I think you
had. Yeah, I had a follow up to your response to his. I think it was his first question.
Yeah, I think it may have been the second, actually. Well, I tackled them in the reverse
in any
order.
Case,
but, yeah.
It sounded like your response to the Augustinian privation line would amount to an argument that God couldn't create a finite world at all, or could be used, pushed into that direction.
Yeah, indeed. So, you know, it's another reason why we've got a problem on our hands. But it does, I mean, it is an argument that can very readily, I think, be pushed in that direction. The whole relationship between the infinite and the finite, which is certainly relevant to this debate, is quite naturally, I think, modelled on a relationship between what's wholly positive and what involves some sort of negation. And again, plenty of examples in the history of philosophy and theology of people who have seen things in those terms. We've been talking about the problem of suffering, but as soon as you start thinking in these very abstract terms, it's not long before you can begin to see it as the problem of creation, you know, the problem of the finite. You know, how can there be anything finite at all, given this infinite God whose existence we're accepting for the purposes of this debate? Yes, at the back. Yeah.
Yeah. The Pope John Paul II wrote an interesting popular book, not an academic book, a few years ago. Obviously, before he died, entitled On the Threshold of Hope. And he deals with the trilemma essentially by suggesting that the omnipotence of God is demonstrated and accomplished eschatologically, and in the interim, the omnibenevolence of God is demonstrated by his participation in our suffering vis-a-vis the cross, so therefore there is no trilemma. And I'm curious how you would respond to that logic.
The idea that God participates in our suffering is crucial to the Christian tradition, obviously, and it's a very deep and powerful idea. I just think that the bit at the very end is too quick. I mean, it's crucial for anybody with a Christian belief that the suffering that there isn't something from which God is completely distanced. That's something that goes very deep in the tradition, and it's deep and it's important. But the idea that it gets round the intellectual problem, that it enables us to say, therefore there is no trilemma, just seems to me too quick. I mean, it looks to me as if we're just still back at square one. We've got this suffering, which now admittedly we're thinking of as partly God's own suffering, and that's a very, very, very important twist to the original problem. But it doesn't seem to me to solve the original problem. It's putting a very, very distinctive gloss on it, but it's not solving it, is my reaction. Perhaps you see things very differently.
Well, only because there's the eschatological solving the problem. So if...
But how is it a solution?
Well, because if in the trilemma the omnipotent God would put an end to suffering, therefore ending the trilemma, because he exercises omnipotence by removing suffering, the eschatological belief that is accomplished but is not yet realized, and in the interim God is not removed but participating, I think the trilemma goes away.
Well, the problem is the very idea that there should be such a thing as an interim, I suppose. That's why there does still seem to me to be the original intellectual problem.
Well, there are a lot of theological reasons why there's an interim. So this is where theology and philosophy would diverge.
Well,
if one understood or appreciated the theological reasons for the interim, and can make a logical case for the theological reasons for the interim, there is no intellectual problem anymore because it fits into the construct theological.
Yeah. Sure. No, I can see the shape of the response, and ultimately there may be something satisfactory along those lines. And if there were, you would hope and expect that it would satisfy philosophers as well as theologians. I mean, if it makes sense, and it ought to make sense to both alike. But obviously, the devil's going to be in the detail. If you'll pardon me putting it that way.
My question, I think, is similar to the last. I was actually, from the very beginning of the talk, I was thinking, well, what about when we complicate things? We're introducing the incarnation and the passion, right? The idea that God suffers. But I think there's maybe two things that complicate it even more. One is that you said, well, there's a puzzle about how, given an infinite God, there could be creation at all. But here, in the case of Christ, we're considering God being crucified by his own creation unjustly.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking, isn't it, if you can see Leibniz's response as a sort of instance of the third case, right, where we're after a sort of intellectual sort of tranquility, right? Because we've sort of resolved an intellectual puzzle. He said, well, there's a sort of uneasiness you feel about that because you're thinking, well, look, isn't this actually a practical problem in some respect? I'm wondering, then, if we take seriously the idea of incarnation and the idea that God was crucified by his own creation, then we sort of have this moment where, like Job, right, we repent in ashes, because we realize, look, even though we might not be able to fully understand what it was like to suffer as badly as Jesus Christ did, we know that he suffered far more than we ever, than we can even possibly imagine.
Mm.
And so there's a sense in which then when you understand, well, why is it that Jesus Christ suffered? Well, it's to basically pay the price. Well, I'm not, so we can set aside theories of the atonement.
Uh-huh.
But in some sense, right, his own suffering is a consequence of my own doings.
Yes.
Then if we go back to the first question about, well, what's the justice involved with there being suffering and evil in the world, it doesn't really seem as if the question is, how is suffering compatible with there being a God? Rather, the question is, what am I going to do in response to the fact that, in some sense,
yeah,
I can see that I'm the cause of suffering and creation, right? That,
yeah,
it's not God that we need to figure, but it's, what am I doing that's contributing to the suffering in the sense that,
yeah,
that led to the crucifixion? Right?
Yes.
So,
yes.
I, obviously, that's a heavily theological
Sure.
way of approaching it, but it just,
yeah,
seems to me, from the philosophical standpoint, part of the reason why the problem of suffering is never being intellectually solved is that at that kind of level of abstraction, where we're just talking about a God, or he's omnipotent, he's omnibenevolent, he's this or that, we're never going to get the full story, as it were, until you introduce the full apparatus of the sort of Christian conception of the Creator, right?
Yeah. And there's an enormous amount there that I'm very, very sympathetic to. I mean, you've said a lot of really interesting things. I suppose one question that I have is a question that arises about the way that you put it right at the very end. I mean, when you came back to the intellectual problem and said, look, you know, of course the intellectual problem hasn't been properly solved because we're not, you know, we're thinking in terms that are overly abstract. I mean, we're not thinking about this full, very dramatic picture that you painted. And I guess my question to you is, do you see this as a way of admitting that actually the intellectual problem does remain unsolved, and as it were, so much the worse for the intellectual problem? I mean, the mistake was to think that, you know, that was something that merited all this attention in the first place. Is that the attitude, or is the attitude rather that in fact it was rather poorly posed, but once we get it into suitably sharp focus, there is a solution to the intellectual problem.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see?
I was going to say the former.
Yeah.
And now I'm not sure because I want to say both.
Yes. Yes.
So what I want to say,
speaking
from my own experience, right? When I was an atheist, I used to love the problem of suffering because I thought I got them right off the hook.
Yeah.
I said, well, you know, only an idiot could possibly think that there could be an all-loving, all-powerful, all-knowing God.
Mm.
And there's so much suffering, right? Like, who could ever believe in such a thing?
Yeah.
Whereas now, as a Christian, I can see the intellectual problem as a sort of temptation of thought, right? That in a way that you were suggesting, it can lead us away from what maybe the true spirit of the question is, which is a practical response to it. I can now see that that the very act of posing a question in that way, right, can in fact actually be a sort of instance of the very kind of rebellion.
Yeah.
That Christ was made incarnate for and went to the cross. So in a sense, it's like, if I truly understood the glory of creation and what it means to be a free being who sort of sullied it, right, in virtue of my free will, then the question about whether or not that's compatible with some sort of abstract conception of God just totally goes out the window when I realize that I have to do something about what it is to be the sort of being that has done what I've done, and that becomes the pressing question, right?
Yes.
So they can kind of work in tandem, I mean, perhaps or something, but it really reframes the question entirely, where I no longer see myself as a sort of abstract thinker wondering, how does evil fit into a creation with a perfect being, when I realize that, in fact, there's evil in this creation so far as I've contributed to it, right? That I've, that I've acted equally, right?
Sure. No, I find all of that very interesting. And another thing that I think is related to what you've just been saying, and in its own way perhaps equally interesting, is the whole question of the relationship between this problem that we've been looking at this evening and atheism. Because you might think that you might expect that a lot of people would be atheists because of the existence of suffering. And no doubt there are plenty of people who are atheists because of the existence of suffering, but it's nothing like the tight correlation that you might anticipate. Nothing like, I mean, there's a less serious point and a more serious point to be made in this connection. The less serious point, less serious, I don't know if that's the right way to describe it, but just as a matter of interest, I mean, I know as somebody who teaches the philosophy of religion, and in particular quite often cover this topic with undergraduates, that over the years that I've been teaching it, I've had many undergraduates that have been avowed atheists who have nevertheless not thought that there was a difficult intellectual problem here. So, as it were, the correlation breaks down that way, and they, you know, their atheism is for completely, completely different reasons. But then, the thing that I was describing is more serious. I shouldn't use the word serious here, but perhaps what I mean is more striking. Is the way in which, conversely, you often find, I think, that, and I don't know whether this ties in with your own personal experience or not, but you often find that people who go through terrible suffering actually come to a belief in God rather than the opposite as a result of it. It's very often that way. I mean, just as a matter of brute fact, I mean, we could obviously speculate on the reasons why and talk about how these processes work. But I think it just is a matter of brute fact that it's often when people are in moments of crisis or extreme suffering of one kind or another, or perhaps even just anticipating suffering, that they find themselves drawn to a belief in God that they might not even have had before, or that their belief in God becomes firmer than it was before. So that's a striking fact as well. And it's a further reminder of the thing that I suppose I was shaping up to at the end of my remarks, which is that there's this curious mismatch between what's going on intellectually and what's going on practically. And I think that mismatch manifests itself in all sorts of different ways, and this is just a further illustration. You have a comeback?
Yeah, just really fast, because I got going and I missed the whole essential point, which is what you said at the outset, the distinction between intellectual and practical sort of responses to the problem, right? Well, I mean, if I was just thinking yesterday, I was reading the book of Matthew, chapter 25, verses 31-46. Jesus Christ talks about when he separates, right, the goats from the sheep, one of the things he's going to do is he's going to tell the unrighteous, right, that, and this is where the Catholics have the seven acts of mercy, but they never fed the hungry, they never visited those that were in prison. So Jesus Christ himself says, right, that the problem of suffering, insofar as he sees it, is in fact a practical one.
Yeah.
Because you can imagine a philosopher who spends his entire life worrying about how, in fact, the existence of suffering is compatible with an omnipotent God, and on Judgment Day, God is going to say, well, what did you do to help the people who are suffering?
Yeah, and
so
that was...
I think this is really consonant with what you're saying, at least.
Yeah.
It's not that the intellectual question matters not at all.
No.
But indeed. If anything, it should just be an impetus to actually go and do something.
Yeah. Well, certainly if it interferes with practice, then something's gone wrong.
Right.
And you know, I mean, we don't have to be that pessimistic, and we don't have to think that we're faced with a choice between either thinking about it intellectually and doing nothing, or getting practically involved and not thinking about it at all. I mean, it doesn't have to be one extreme or the other. But for people who are reflective and who do have some sort of faith, there's nevertheless a balance to be struck, and I think there are genuine practical questions about how to strike the balance. Yeah.
Well, I did very much appreciate that at the end you came around to that issue of the tension between the intellectual and practical problem, and I wonder if the safer way to approach it, to avoid overshadowing it with this intellectual problem, is to in some ways divide them and to leave with the intellectual problem a general, the general existence of evil, you know, that evil does exist, and then very much focus on the specifics of suffering for the practical problems, you know, this specific instance of suffering, and what as Christians we are meant to be addressing, you know, like in that passage in Matthew, rather than what people sometimes attempt to do, and I think generally does not work, of trying to trace some sort of specific purpose to a specific suffering. And then becoming dismissive of it because they can explain away why this suffering is happening.
Yeah. No, I think you're making an important point. I mean, there is... I think there is a correlation between what I've been calling the intellectual, practical divide that arises here and something like the general and particular divide that there is as well. I mean, when we're thinking about this problem in intellectual terms, as we have been doing this evening, the chances are that we will be thinking about it in very general and very abstract terms, as we have been doing this evening. If you start trying to broach the problem in very particular terms and also in fundamentally intellectual terms, I'm sure you're right, but it's not long before something will just go badly wrong, you know, when you're trying to trace out particular connections that will satisfy you intellectually. You know, you're probably just barking up the wrong tree. But when it comes to engaging practically with suffering, then necessarily it's going to be the particular that confronts you, not the general. And you're going to be faced with a particular set of circumstances with its own particular challenges that confront you as a particular human being. The practical problems that arise are necessarily particular ones, not general ones. You know, who could practically confront the problem of suffering in general terms? I mean, that would be crazy. So I think, I think that's an important dimension to this discussion as well.
So two quick questions. First, in Leibniz's solution, does he admit space for free will? If this is the best of all possible worlds, then at some level, how could we ever, you know, alter it from that? Mm-hmm. And thus, at some level, are we all pieces of the painting fulfilling some sort of preordained role in that painting? And then the second question is, going to the question of those who experience suffering and become, or deepen in their faith, or come to believe in God, is there anything intellectually fruitful from putting weight on the idea that the conception of suffering somehow is fundamentally different or transfigured through the experience of suffering?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what is it to be of that? What is it to suffer? And somehow from there's some sort of way of changing what we're talking about that yields some sort of intellectual fruit.
Yeah. That's really interesting as well. I mean, as far as your first question is concerned. It's not very often in philosophy that there's a simple yes or no answer. In this particular case, there is. I mean, you're asking whether Leibniz's account of these matters leaves room for free will, and the answer is yes. He does believe in free will, and that is part of the picture. The question how it can be part of the picture, in a way, goes back to my response to the very first question that arose this evening. You know, why does the classic free will defence to the intellectual problem not satisfy me? One of the things that I was gesturing at in response to that was, well, it doesn't satisfy me because even if you believe in free will, it still looks as if you know, there should be the possibility of this being the best of all possible worlds and God creating it for that very reason. Because after all, you know, there is this very, very famous account due to Leibniz in which you have both elements together. Leibniz's own way of getting around this problem is to say, well, actually, this is the best of all possible worlds. Most of us don't want to bite that particular bullet. But if we think that the sheer existence of free will somehow gets us around the intellectual problem, we nevertheless have to reckon with it as a possibility. That's why we're dissatisfied with it. And as regards your second point, yes, I'm sure that your conception of suffering is going to depend very, very heavily on what you've actually experienced. I mean, all of us do suffer in various ways, and I suppose the operative word there is various. I mean, people do suffer in different ways, and you know, we're not all familiar with what other people have gone through. Even in this room, none of us will have experienced suffering of the same kind. But when you do suffer, perhaps in new ways, there is, I'm sure, a sense in which your very conception of suffering is affected as a result of that. And painful though it may be, perhaps what happens is that your conception of suffering is enriched as a result of that. Whether that enrichment helps, either with the theoretical intellectual problem or with various practical problems, is a further question. There are all sorts of ways in which I can see that it might help practically, and in particular it might mean that you're better equipped to be of assistance to other people that are experiencing similar suffering. I suppose it's not obvious to me how it's going to help with the intellectual problem.
That may be all the time we have. Unless there's maybe one more quick one. Someone's just really burned. Sure, one more. Is that okay?
So, thanks so much. So, we're wondering about the problem of suffering as a response to, even like the problem as a response to the suffering of others. So, you seem to be saying very plausibly that the unique right response to the suffering of others is to alleviate it, and the worry is, and that's for that, pondering the intellectual problem seems to be a poor substitute. I was thinking that it might be helpful to draw attention to the connection between belief and action. We can't implement any sort of plan of action without beliefs. And maybe that for some people in some circumstances, one of the important beliefs will be a traditional theistic belief.
Yeah.
That's, if you started out believing that, you'd shape your life around that, and you're suddenly in deep doubt about it. Might be that finding some solution satisfactory to you to the intellectual problem is a prerequisite for meaningful action towards the alleviation of suffering.
I think that's another really good point. There is There is an associated danger, though, as well, I think. I mean, I don't know. Different people in the room will have their own different views about how often this danger is realised. But I think there may be a certain cast of mind whereby there is a link between belief and action in this area, but it's a very sinister and disturbing link. And what I have in mind is, I think there are people who feel that in one way or another they've come to terms with the intellectual problem and allow that to translate into a kind of inactivity, a kind of acquiescence. I mean, even if it only happens subconsciously, even if they don't, you know, think it through explicitly in those terms, that there's a sort of resignation and a feeling, well, it's all okay because it's all part of God's great plan. And as I say, I mean, you know, we all have our views about how serious a danger this is, how often people do allow themselves to think in these ways. But I'm sure that it sometimes happens, and it's a threat that I think we all need to be aware of. And then I suppose the other point is that, you know, even putting that one threat to one side, thought that you need a really satisfactory solution to the intellectual problem before you can get on with the practical business is itself slightly unnerving, isn't it? Because it's so unobvious that a really satisfactory solution to the intellectual problem is available.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Professor Moore. That was really, really interesting and great discussion, I think. Let's just thank him again for